Welcome to Wherever You Are. I'm Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to the 49th episode of the Matinee Cast. It's the official podcast of thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Today, it's time to say goodbye to 2011. But before we do, it's customary to take a moment and look back on the year that was. It's the moment to think about what really stood out and talk lovingly about it for one more time. So to do this, I've gathered a few friends here to sum up the year that was before we crack the seal on 2012. My first guest should be a familiar voice, as he was my co-host during the summertime on the Film Locker. He also writes for his own site, Screen Insight. He writes for Flickering Myth, and also for Man, I Love Films. Where do you find the time to do anything else?
I write a little bit for all of them, and the least for my own. So
I see.
That's generally how I work that out.
He's also a truly great friend. Next to him is a voice that might be familiar to listeners of the dearly departed Simon and Joe Film Show, albeit only slightly familiar, as the boys lovingly cut her off at almost every turn. They are both across a wire from London, England this morning. Please welcome Simon Collum and Sarah Meadows to the show. How are you, folks?
Good, thank you. Nice to have a voice.
And rounding out this podcast double date, who better to sum up the year at the movies than the woman I went to most of the amount of movies with? The former Lady Hatter, Miss Lindsay Rigoni, joins me on my left. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. I don't think I went to the most movies with you, but...
You went to a lot of them.
I went to a lot, but we went to mostly separate movies this year.
Oh, sure. Okay. We'll go with that. Just one short note before we go on. The music you'll hear under the conversation of this episode is a collection of some of my favorite songs from the year. Just a little extra touch I like to add to the year-end show. We'll be counting down our top five films in episode 49 in just a moment. But first, let's get to know more about my guests. This is Know Your Enemy. You do not recall Simon's appearance on the Matinee Cast, I don't blame you, because he first showed up all the way back in episode number 9. There, we learned that the first film he'd seen was The Pagemaster. The last film he'd watched was Kidulthood. His least favorite film is Bad Boys. His blind spot was for... He summed it up as 80s pop culture. Have you made any headway on any of those?
A little bit, I think. What? Yeah, no.
Like,
no.
You hadn't even seen Ferris Bueller.
No, actually. Wow. I haven't seen Ferris Bueller. I haven't seen The Breakfast Club. I saw Pretty Woman. No, not Pretty Woman, Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, yeah. It's been almost 2 years. You realize this, right?
But the thing is, there's this box set I've seen called Rewind to the 80s, and they're all, like, ones which you guys, everyone else, has seen, but I haven't. So, yeah, I want to hunt that down, I think. When it's like a tenner, I think I might get it.
Get on it. And the film he wished he'd made was Jurassic Park. Now, Lindsay, of course, has answered the second set of five questions. So we're just going to heckle Simon and Sarah as we ask them the second round of Know Your Enemy questions. So we will begin with Sarah. Sarah, what's a film that you love that everybody else dislikes?
We had quite a debate about this. But my first kind of response was the Carry On films, and I couldn't really specify any of those, but I loved them. And then Simon said most people actually quite like them. I think it might have to be Sunshine, because I know the ending of that has been debated a lot as not being perhaps the strongest of endings for that film, but I particularly like that one.
I love Sunshine. Actually, we talked about that in episode 48, which is going on. It's going up today, so I don't blame you if you didn't know that. But given Simon's affinity for Danny Boyle, I'm wondering now, is that his effect on you, or is that one?
Quite possibly, yeah.
Well, then, well done. Simon, you're up. What's a film that you love that everybody else hates? And now, of course, you can't say Sunshine.
Well, no, of course. I think I'd say I'm not too much. I like the Matrix sequels.
Really?
I like the whole of the Matrix, and I think the second and third one. There's a documentary, and I always go on about it whenever I talk about this, called The Philosophy of the Matrix, and it's on the box set, that really big, like, 10-disc DVD thing or something.
I have that.
And it's brilliant. It basically shows how. The thing is with those second and third films is that they've just got so much stuff in it. It's really difficult to basically make out what's going on. And when I first saw The Matrix Reloaded, I really disliked it. Or not disliked it, I just didn't really... I kind of came out kind of always feeling like I'd missed something. And so I went out of my way to find out information about it. And the more I found out, the more I found out how, I don't know, for want of a better word, kind of intelligent those two films are, because there's so much going on with it. I think...
Well, I really like Reloaded. I wasn't too keen on Revolutions. I just think that they ran out of money by the time they got that. You didn't like either one of those, did you?
The second one had... I don't remember which one's which. The second and the third.
They blend together for
it
you?
It had some really good sequences.
Yeah.
And I remember some really good sequences, but kind of a blah movie. And the third one, I remember being kind of bored, but that was so long ago, and I've never rewatched it.
But it's on TV, like, every Sunday.
I know, but that really does not help a movie.
Let's see. Okay, we're back to Sarah. What is a film that you dislike that everybody else loves?
It's controversial. I hate Star Wars.
Wow.
All of them. I think they're appalling. Simon, it might have something to do with the fact that Simon made me watch all of them over 1 week. And by the end, I was just... It was an unbelievable experience. I think we could have finished our relationship over watching that. I just thought it was really, really overrated. I couldn't believe kind of how much attention is played to the CGI characters and all those other things. I just thought the story was just boring.
Okay. And when did this travesty happen?
It was only a couple of weeks back. Because Sarah had never seen the last... She'd never seen the ones from the 70s and the 80s. So I was like, you know, well, you've got to watch them. You might not like the prequels, but you've got to watch the originals just to have an opinion.
You know, right? They're awful.
Okay, you're right. That's a controversial one for sure. And I don't think I've met anybody who dislikes them before. So you know, you're quite unique in that.
I'm sure lots do.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. They certainly don't admit it to me. That's
like
sure.
A deep, dark secret.
Do you dislike them?
No, I do not.
Okay, because we might have to have a talk.
I told you I saw, not the originals, but the last one.
Yeah.
I saw six times in the theater.
Oh my God.
But I was dating a super nerd at the time, so.
More super nerdy than me?
Different kind of nerd. He's like a D&D nerd.
Oh, what? Yeah.
You're more of a...
That's the kind of nerd I pick on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Simon, you're up. What's a film that you dislike that everybody else digs?
I hate Driving Miss Daisy. It's crap.
That just seems mean.
Why I'm laughing. Just declaratively like that. I love it.
I just I think it was just a bit obvious, really, the point they're trying to make.
Okay.
I mean, it's not exactly... You know, they're not really tackling something in a very complex fashion.
No.
Old white woman's a racist. The other guy's nice. Yeah. Great.
Okay.
And then it won Best Picture.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. That is just ridiculous.
No, that's brilliant, buddy. I love it. Sarah, what's the last film to make you cry?
That would have to be Up. We watched it again recently, so I've watched it twice now. And it is that opening sequence. It's just wonderful. I just think the... it's just very touching. And it really picks up on those particular moments of their life together. And I just thought it was very cleverly done, and the second time I watched it as well, still made me cry. I knew what was going to happen. Yeah, I just think it's very, very touching. No matter what age you are, I think you can relate to that and how it affects a couple. Yeah, I thought it was a very, very sad film, but still uplifting at the end.
It's that score in the opening, that whimsical little tango that they play that really kind of underlines the sadness. No?
I cry that whole, like, the first 20 minutes I cry, and the last 20 minutes I cry a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, there we go.
I've been crying a lot in movies. I don't know why.
What was the last film to make you cry?
The last one, and this could have been in my top five, it was actually at number six, so was The King's Speech, because obviously it was released here in January, and that was the one. And I think that the thing with King's Speech is that, you know, as a guy, I think the pressure to be a man and all that kind of thing, I think there's a real personal connection there. So when he's there and, you know, he's like doing that last speech at the end, and there's one bit when he just comes out, I think, and Helena Bonham Carter just says, you know, I'm so proud of you. And that was really sad. And I was in tears then. And then the other bit was when he was at the table, like, you know, and he's struggling. And he's there going, you know, I wasn't meant to be king. This wasn't meant to happen. And you're just like, whoa, you know, that's tough.
Okay, good answer, good answer. Sarah, in the movie of your life, who plays you?
I'm not quite sure if it's true. I'd pick Christina Ricci. I've been told the similarities, especially when she's in Adam's family. I'm not quite sure if that's flattering or not, but I would go for her.
I can actually, now that you say it, because I'm looking at you on the video, I'm like, yeah. Like, I like Christina Ricci. I've seen her in person and she's very pretty. But yeah, you look a lot like her.
There we go. Simon?
I'm going to be really... I don't think I look like this guy, but I'd like to think that he'd be proud to play me. And that's Ryan Phillippe.
Okay.
He's... yeah, ideally within the Cruel Intentions phase. You know what I mean? That's when he was badass and he was cool. And yeah, that's who's going to play me. Done.
Well done. And last but not least, maybe you guys can answer this one together. What are you watching next?
Thursday, we are watching...
Well, we're watching Mission Impossible 4 on Thursday.
Nice.
And this evening, we're going to watch Mission Impossible 2. Because we watched Mission Impossible this morning, Mission Impossible 2, and then Mission Impossible 3 tomorrow.
Very cool. I also have myself a copy of Mission Impossible 3 to watch, because I've never seen it.
I've never seen any Mission Impossible, though.
None of them?
Oh!
I really need Tom Cruise, though.
Oh. I really... We might have to remedy this.
He's got that smug little face, and I don't think I can appreciate the film, because his face is on it a lot.
The Mission Impossible films are just, they're so different. I mean, the directors all have their own completely, like, unique stamp on them. I mean, John Woo and... Mission Impossible 2 and Brian De Palma Mission Impossible 1. I mean, they couldn't be more different, and yet it's the same character and all that kind of stuff.
That is more about Simon and Sarah. No feedback question from last week, but for next week, what I would like to know is, what is the 2012 film you're most looking forward to seeing? Let me know, Ryan at thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I am matinee_ca, or just leave a comment on the blog. And that will take us to the best of you. This is the top five of 2011. Come on back right after this. We are going to go around the table, and just so everybody knows, there is a little bit of overlap. We've got 15 films between us, and anytime we run into an overlap, we're just going to, you know, we're going to say a brief thought or two about it and then talk about it when the person has it the highest. So Sarah's going to get us started. Sarah, what was your number five film of 2011?
That would have been Super 8. I just thought, when I saw it in the cinema, I'm not quite sure how it transferred to DVD or indeed Blu-ray when I watched it, but I just thought it was a really good action film. I thought the use of sound was excellent, and I just thought a lot of the child actors in there were really impressive, and it just seemed a really typical kind of, even though Spielberg was producing it, it just seemed to have that really good Spielberg influence on it that just reminded me a lot of his older films.
Really playful.
Yeah.
You know?
And just a really good story that it told.
Definitely. Now, I have not seen it since the theater, because I haven't picked up the Blu-ray or DVD. I'm hoping it's underneath our Christmas tree, but of course I don't know that yet. You dug Super 8.
I saw it a lot later than you, because I wasn't really interested in it, and then like months, I think right before it left the theater, I went by myself to see it. It had a weird nostalgia to it for a new film. Like, it felt like I was watching E.T.
or something.
Goonies. It had that that old, my childhood nostalgic. I loved it. I really loved it.
Yeah, me too. The only thing that I think about it, when I think back on it now, like, I loved it to death. I was really, really happy with the way it evoked those same kind of memories that Lindsay's talking about, and had that execution that Sarah, that you mentioned about. The only thing I wish a little bit more is, I believe the very next week, I went and saw Attack the Block. And the creature design in Attack the Block was just so wonderful. I wish the creature design in Super 8 had been a little bit more original. That's the only thing I, as I say, I love Super 8 to death. I'm looking forward to finally seeing it again. But that's the only thing I wish, is that it had a little bit better creature design. But you're right. It's got Spielberg stamped all over it. He only produced it, but he might as well have directed it. Simon, you're up. What is your number five film of the year?
It's got to be somewhere, and mine's going to be Hugo.
Attaboy.
So, I loved it. I reckon it's going to be get better. It'll be better on a second viewing. But I think there was a really great idea. I mean, I think it was just for someone who loves cinema, and for me anyway, I've been watching a lot of Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton recently, and it was just remarkable that he could turn I mean, all the stuff, the fact that it was in 3D and talking about the magic of cinema, whilst, you know, innovating himself with that at the same time, kind of paying respect to the past. Ben Kingsley was magnificent. Jude Law was not annoying. I mean, that's a rare occurrence. Lots of, you know, I just thought it was a really brilliant film. And for me, I'm hoping, obviously, in my school, I'm going to obviously show it to the kids when I do get it on DVD eventually.
Very, very nice. Sarah, did you enjoy it?
No. I fell asleep after half an hour and then woke up again and was dismayed to find it was still playing. I thought Sacha Baron Cohen was good. He gave an impressive performance. I just thought it was a bit self-indulgent, to be honest. I like some of the imagery. I like the clock and inside the clock. Thought some of that was really impressive and some of the views of Paris. I thought it was a bit self-indulgent and a bit... I thought they could have explored the history of film in a bit more detail, I think. I think it skimmed at the surface a bit.
Hmm. I think you're somewhere in between Simon and Sarah here, aren't you?
Yeah, I didn't love it, but I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I saw it in 3D.
Okay, you get one time to say this in the whole show, so
okay,
get it out of your system now.
I hate 3D. I think it's pointless. I think it has no place in storytelling, and it takes me out of the film. Every time I have a sense of wonder and I'm looking at a shot, and then something jumps out at me, or I become aware of the glasses on my face, I remember, oh yeah, it's just a movie.
Okay.
And it pulls me away. I've said it.
Yeah.
But I think if I had seen Hugo in 2D, I think I would have liked it more, because there's elements. I liked all the side stories, even though they were really small. The Sacha Baron Cohen and just the older couple whose names I'm blanking on.
Richard Griffiths,
yeah,
I remember.
Yeah, it was so small. But I liked those little touches to it, and there's a lot in the film that I liked. It's just something kind of left me cold. As
really?
A whole, it was maybe a little long, and I don't really know who the film was meant for.
Well, that's the funny thing about it. Now, I loved it a lot, actually, and it just missed my five. It's one that I think is going to improve the more I watch it, and I am looking forward to seeing it again. But I think it's for... I said this in my review, that it's actually for the kind of kid who's into... You know, the stuff that normal kids aren't into. It's not for the kind of kid who's into sports and video games. It's for the kid who's interested in science, or who's interested in building, or, you know, we have a friend whose child wants to work for Weta. He wants to work on stuff like Planet of the Apes and Lord of the Rings.
Maybe he's listening to this. Hi, Kai.
I think this is a film for him. It's a film for the kind of child who's interested in how things work.
Right.
And you know, specifically movies. I loved it. I think more than you, it sounds like, and certainly more than Sarah. But it's definitely one. I didn't expect it to work as well as it did, and I was really, really surprised with how well it worked.
That is one. You won't hear me say this a lot, but I will see it again.
Hey, cool!
We'll give it another shot.
The 3D, I've got to say, if you don't like 3D, fine. But the thing is, the 3D with Hugo has so much purpose to it. You know what I mean? The idea that, you know, the fact that they're talking about the train coming out of the screen back with the Lumiere brothers, and then at the same time they're showing these actual visual sight, these techniques which are literally taking things out of the screen and all that type of stuff. I feel like, unlike God knows how many other films, I know Tintin's one, which I kind of wish I didn't see in 3D. Just because it's so beautiful, but whereas with Hugo, it's so intricate and so much a part of the story.
You get to move us on to a film that you did love.
Oh.
So, okay. What was your number five film of the year?
I'm going to say 50-50.
Very nice. Has that come out over there yet, guys?
It did.
Yeah.
Nice.
It got some Golden Globe stuff, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Did it?
Yep.
I didn't expect to like it as much as I did, but it had so much heart and... You know, I've been through a similar situation where I was kind of the Seth Rogen character, where I had a close person who was going through something similar, and I thought they handled it really well, and I loved all the characters in it. I just thought it was a really good film where they dealt with cancer, and they did it dramatically, but at the same time they kept it light and humor, and in a way that I think a lot of real people would have done.
Hmm.
I was really touched by it.
Yeah, Sarah, did you see it?
No, we haven't seen it yet. I don't know if we will be.
I think I'd like to see it. I think it's one of those things, isn't it? I mean, when it first came out, I thought it was like this kind of comedy, You know, yeah. So I just kind of thought, okay, we'll see how the ball kind of rolls. But now it's getting a lot more credibility. I'm kind of thinking, okay, fine, I might give it a shot, but I'll have to hunt it down.
Yeah, they're calling it a cancer comedy. It is a comedy, but very little. I'd say it's like 30% comedy. It's mostly like a heartfelt film about a guy going through cancer.
Yeah, it's a lighter drama. Like, there are some heavy moments, but it's about the, yeah, you know, the drama of trying to go through this kind of thing. And
I know the director, it's based on the writer, it's based on his personal experience, and he is actually a friend of Seth Rogen, so Seth Rogen was playing himself in the film, in the actual situation, and it's actually what they went through. The writer basically said, you know, if you go through something like that, you can let your life crash in on you, or you can look at the bright side. And that's, I think he wrote it as he experienced it.
Yeah. I mentioned this when we talked about it with Leora about, on the Thanksgiving show, that it's an interesting performance by Joseph Gordon-Levitt because he's got all these things going on at the same time with dealing with this cancer. He's very afraid. He's very, you know, he's very angry. And sometimes he is actually in a good mood. And he's kind of got to balance it all. So he does it very, very subtly. And it's really, really wonderful to see what he brings to the various scenes. So, yeah, guys, I definitely say check it out when you can. And
Angelica Houston, I always love.
Oh, she plays his mom, and she's fantastic as his mom.
It's one of the few films, because she never plays real people. I don't know, yeah. Like, do you know what I mean? She always plays really out there, like in strange movies or strange characters, and we rarely see her as like a regular human being.
Yeah, yeah, she plays cartoons.
Yeah, she does, and I like her. I mean, I love her and everything, but I loved her in this little role.
Nice. Well, it's finally my turn, and I would be betraying my heart and my childhood if I did not start the list with my number five being The Muppets. Did you guys see that one yet?
It's not been released yet.
Really?
It's not come out yet. No.
Oh, that's a shame.
They've just started the early publicity now.
Okay. Well, then, again, you've got something great to look forward to this year. I ended up feeling like a great big kid watching this movie. It ran a risk because it could have very easily turned into parody. It could have turned into something that was trying to shoehorn modern pop culture into itself. But it really, really lovingly carries on the tradition of those first movies, the Muppet movie, The Great Muppet Caper, and The Muppets Take Manhattan. And it moved me in just unexpected ways. I was like crying like a baby on more than one occurrence of the film. There was moments in it that just made me sad, that made me really happy, that were very, very beautiful. And just overall, it is a movie of unparalleled joy. That I loved. It is technically flawed. There are lots of little storytelling holes and things that don't entirely work, but I can't possibly deny the amount of happiness it brought me. So for that one, I had to put it on my year-end top five. You?
Were you a fan? Have you always been a big fan of the Muppets then?
Yeah. Like, I grew up with them, and what was more was that I came back to them around the time I turned 13 or 14, and I started to understand some of the more adult notions to the jokes, like the vaudeville of the jokes and the corny humor. So I ended up loving them more when I became a teenager. So, yeah, I brought all of that in with me.
I'm surprised that made your top five. I have to say, I'm impressed, and I kind of love you a little bit extra right now. And not because I knew you loved the movie, but that, I don't know, I'm going to say this politely, but you tend to err towards the pretentious. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to say yourself. Especially for your stuff like your top fives, even though you'll secretly love stuff like this. So the fact that you've actually put it on your top, and it's not on my top five, that's shocking.
I was going to say, if somebody were to look at our top fives and think one of them is going to have a Lars von Trier film and one of them is going to talk about Muppets.
I haven't even said that yet.
I know. They wouldn't think that it would be this way. But
no,
yeah.
But Muppets did make my top 10. It just missed. I think after my top five, I had like Attack the Block and the Muppets and Super 8 that just missed it.
And what did you enjoy about it?
Everything. The music is incredible, and it's written by Brett from Flight of the Conchords, I believe.
Yep.
The part where they all get together and sing the Muppet Show theme, it's not even a big moment. It's just I had chills all over my body. My tears were welling up. It was just I was very emotional. I'm emotional thinking about it. I don't know why. I've seen it twice now, and I loved it both times.
Guys, do either one of you have, like, did you either one of you grow up with them, enjoy them, that kind of thing? Like, do you have a history?
Not really, actually. Not really. I Muppets are big over here, but I don't think on such a scale as it is over there. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we've got a really close friend who's a really big fan, and she's looking forward to it. Every year she'll watch Christmas Carol and all that type of thing. But it's not as big over here, I think, you know what I mean, as it is over in on the other side of the Atlantic. You know?
Nice. Well, we're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be back with our number fours after this. So this brings us to our number four. Sarah, why don't you get us started? What was your number four film of the year?
It was Bridesmaids.
Very nice. And why?
Well, when I went to see it at the cinema, it was a really nice experience because everyone was laughing so much straight from the beginning. I just thought it was just full of silly little jokes, full of clever jokes, and it was just, not to reveal too much about it, but I just thought it was quite daring for some female actresses to do this type of comedy. All I'll say is there's the one scene when they're trying on the bridesmaids' dresses and just the actions that they do to create the comedy, I just thought was brilliant. And you'd normally see in comedies mainly acted by males, so I just thought it was quite challenging for them to do that as well, quite daring, quite new, quite inventive. The only reason it's at number four is I just thought the ending was just a bit misguided. When the music comes in right at the end, I just thought it just got a bit lost at the end. But apart from that, I thought it was a brilliant film, and I can't wait to buy it and watch it again, and hopefully it'll be just as funny.
Simon, what do you think of it?
We watched, what is it, What's My Number? Have you heard of that film that was released this year?
Yeah. I remember that one, with Chris Evans and...
Yes.
Yeah, what's her name? Anna Faris, yeah.
That's it, yeah.
Oh.
And we watched that, and it kind of showed how bad some films really are, because that one was like, it was like a chick flick, but it was clearly like she was in very little clothes half the time, and you know what I mean, it was more for the guys, and it was just like there was no tension, it was just, you know. Whereas I think with Bridesmaids, I mean, I really enjoyed it, but what I find is, like, I think to myself, okay, what film preceded that in terms of what type of film kind of gave them the strength to make that film? And I really don't know, and that says how kind of, I don't know, for want of a better word, groundbreaking it kind of felt like it was. Because I think if you think about the Sex and the City kind of girls as one polar opposite to Bridesmaids, you just think it's not the same at all. So it wasn't that. So what was it which kind of gave them the strength to make that? Because it is a really great film, and I don't know what other film is even on a par with that film in terms of an all-female cast, in terms of a comedy. I don't think there is anything I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, I know you love the heck out of it.
Yeah, I'm actually really happy that somebody put it on their top five. I think it's in my top 10. And I have bought it and watched it on DVD, and it is just as funny second watching. I really loved it. I don't think I've seen an all-female cast where they're not all trying to be sexy. Like, I appreciated that the actresses had the guts to just be funny without... Because in a lot of these movies, they're casting actresses in all these comedy movies that come out, like even the Judd Apatow movies, and with the exception of, I think, Leslie Mann is her name,
mm-hmm.
who I think is just always funny. They're casting these girls that are just pretty actresses.
Yeah.
And they're putting them in comedies and calling them comedians, but I don't think they are, because they're always still trying to be funny, and they're always perfectly dressed, and their hair is perfect. Where these girls, it was like... They just let themselves go. It wasn't always a concern about how they looked. They were just funny.
Well, it was. I think it really, really benefited the film that they cast very, very funny women, like,
yeah,
for starters, and worried about how everything.
And Melissa
fit
McCarthy
together.
Is my new hero. I love her.
I really loved Bridesmaids as well. I was really, really surprised by. But just by what it was, because I thought it was really, really oddly marketed. It kind of made it out to be this very slapstick, very...
The Hangover for girls.
Yeah, was what they were saying. And it's not. It was much more thoughtful. I thought that they really were... Kind of the sadness and the conflict that that Annie, the character played by Kristen Wiig, that she was going through of, you know, where her friend was at in terms of their relationship and where she was at with her own kind of just life's journey. I really liked how they worked all that in. And I've become a gigantic fan of Rose Byrne in the last year. Mm-hmm. And I guess between this and Get Him to the Greek, she's really shown how funny she can be.
Yeah, I never would have thought of her as a funny actress.
No, me neither. I don't see her as a comedian, but now anytime she's in something funny, I'll definitely be there. So.
And this was written by women for women.
Yep.
Which you really don't get.
No, you don't. So, good choice, Sarah. Very, very good choice, I think, is what we're all agreeing. Simon, the next one on your list is actually going to come up again, so really briefly, tell people about your number four.
My choice is Tintin. I've gone on about it loads on my blog, on other blogs, on everywhere. So, yeah, I will wax lyrical about it in a bit, but yeah, I mean, I thought it was a brilliant film. Absolutely brilliant.
Very nice. Lens, you're back. What is your pretentious choice for number four?
I know, this is weird. I feel weird.
This is very strange, yeah.
Melancholia.
Did you guys get to see that one?
No. Again, that came and went pretty quick. I think it just came at a busy time in the term, but yeah.
Okay.
I was meaning to see it. Again, Lars von Trier, I had my experience with Antichrist, so, you know,
I see.
Slow and steady. That's how I've got it going.
Tell people about it.
I should say I was fully prepared to hate this movie. I was convinced that I would hate this movie. I don't...
Just to qualify this, we should tell people that we went to the Lightbox on a night where the group of us were fully intending to go see a screening of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yes, yeah, so we went to an 80s night at the Bell Lightbox.
And at the last moment, you and our friend Sasha bailed out and decided to go see a Lars von Trier film.
Yeah, well, because one, we felt that it was, we both wanted to see it, but it's one of those movies we thought... It's, you always intend to see it, but you're never going to actually go see it because it's kind of long and slow. And we kept saying, if we don't see it right now while we're physically at the theater, we will never come back and see it. So we bailed on Fast Times and went to see this. And it started at 10 p.m. and it's a long movie. And it is a very slow movie. And some of it's painful to kind of get through, which isn't normally something I'd like. But the last few minutes of this film are probably the 5 minutes of the most intense film experience I've ever had. The sound in it, I felt like the theater was going to come crumbling down. It was just so, so well sound mixed. And I've never experienced something where the sound made such a difference. I mean, I would give it the Oscar for that that 5 minutes of cinema, just for best sound. It was incredible.
So what about Jack Bauer?
He is actually quite good in it because he's not playing Jack Bauer. He plays actually sort of the nice guy in the movie because it's a movie where you don't like a single character. Everyone's very good in it. Kirsten Dunst, who I'm not normally a big fan of, she's very good in it. Everyone's very good in it, but they're hateable characters. They're all despicable. Every last one of them. And even Kiefer Sutherland, he's not terribly likable, but amongst the group of people that he's in, he kind of comes across as one of the better human beings. Yeah, he's good. Kirsten Dunst gives quite a performance. And I know Ryan was pleased that she was naked once or twice.
Who wouldn't be?
Yes!
He was raving about a couple particular shots that I find interesting, that those are the shots that you just decided to discuss.
Okay. Well, she's splayed out on a rock just bathing in moonlight. You know, it's like a Baroque painting or something. What's not to like?
You're a little too excited about the beauty of that shot.
Please.
It's a great shot, though. It is a great shot.
Sarah, did you have any thoughts on Von Trier or Melancholia? Was this one that you're hoping to catch up with eventually?
I don't think, off the top of my head, I've seen any of his films at all. So his films certainly sound quite strange. But no, I might catch it up.
Sarah does. I told Sarah what happened in Antichrist.
Oh,
and since then, she keeps reminding me of it just by verbally telling me. And I don't think it's fair because she hasn't got the visual memory of that experience.
I'm with Lindsay. I love Melancholia quite a bit. And it is a really, really beautiful film. I think you guys, at the very least, will love... Like, you could watch... I've said this before. You could watch it on mute. It is fabulous looking. It's a really, really cool film. And I actually think it's pretty accessible. So.
But one thing I will say, I don't think it's going to play well on DVD.
I think it still can. You'll lose.
So drawn out and slow. I think you need the big theater experience, especially for the ending. I think if I watched it on DVD, I would have bailed.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have gotten to the end. I would have turned it off. Especially that first, the opening scene. It's about 5 minutes long. So some of the most visually stunning images that I've ever seen. They're very slow motion. They're kind of avant-garde. They don't make much sense. But I kept thinking, as beautiful as they were, is the whole film going to be like this? Because I'm not going to make it.
Yeah, it's shot using a camera that's got an extremely high frame rate. Because of that, actually, I know people who actually thought their DVD was stuck or that their computer was frozen when they saw it. But no, I'm with you. That's an awesome film, and I look forward to seeing it again. Well, my number four is one that I know Simon has seen and I know Lindsay has not seen, and I have no clue on Sarah. My number four is War Horse. My number four was the one that I kind of held off on doing this show so that I can make sure I got to it. I won't get too spoilerific because, as I said, Lindsay hasn't seen it. Sarah, have you seen it?
No.
Okay.
No. Actually, because I teach drama, I've done sections of the play before, so I know the story very well, but I'm eager to see the film. I'd be interested to see how it's transferred to the medium of film, because I know with the play, they're using a lot of puppetry for the horse, and that's really what gets the most praise, is the way that that's been done. It's very, very moving, so I'd be interested to see what they've done in the film.
Yeah, and it's interesting because a lot of what makes this film work so well is the visual element. I'm a huge Steven Spielberg fan, as of course is Simon, and this is him doing what he does best. This is him getting back to films like Empire of the Sun and The Color Purple, which may not be the sort of stories that everybody loves, but are still very, very well done. The way it's been marketed to look like Black Beauty or something like that, and it's really, really not. It's the story of World War I in Europe and how everybody lived through it. You know, this horse gets... to use a bad metaphor, he gets passed back and forth between the sides, between England and Germany, and as well, he spent some time with some people in France, and just...
Oh, you just gave away. Now I don't need to see it. Why are you telling me all this?
You knew this.
No, I did not.
Oh, sorry about that. Simon, what did you think of it? Because I know you saw it as well.
I loved it. My only problem with the film was that was all just about the fact that it was aimed at children. So that's really my issue, in that obviously war is generally very horrific. It's very scary. It's not very nice. It's such tragedy which happens. And this film kind of touches on those things in a way that children can access it. And I think that's a really good thing. That's not the fault of Spielberg, because I think that's what he wants. He wants to make a film for children to access those kind of issues. When if you think about Schindler's List and you think about Saving Private Ryan, I mean, both of them are really show that real horror in terms of the dangers and what has happened, the D-Day landings, the Auschwitz, all that type of stuff is absolutely horrific. And obviously children can't really access that. But with War Horse, you actually have got so much stuff which people can access. And that's a really a testament to his skill as a filmmaker to get those points across without it kind of catering a bit too simplistically.
Yeah, he does short sell World War I a little bit in terms of the horror of it, and which is a shame because, of course, World War I was very, very close combat, was trench warfare, and I would like to see him do a full-out World War I film, but I think that for what he gets in there, he still gets his point across for how intense it was. If I had a qualm with the film, I was a little bit antsy in the opening. I thought it was... a little slow in its first little while, although I did think the goose was very charming, so there's that. So
it's the worst marketing I've ever seen for a movie that I'm sure
it's horse films.
It's not really a horse film, right? There's a lot.
Yeah, but it is. But that's the thing is that there's nothing they can't get around it any other way. It's about a horse.
Well, yeah.
But Black Beauty, I don't care about. Stallion of Camaron. Whatever.
Well, yeah, but like Seabiscuit was a horse film, and they didn't make it look this bad.
No, but that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it was really good. I mean, it's a good film, but the point is that there's no getting around the fact that it's a horse film, and horse films generally look rubbish.
That's true.
I mean, that's just common consensus. If I see a poster of a horse and it says best film ever, I'm going to think it's lying. It's a horse. What are you going to do? Sorry, Spielberg. A horse.
Well, I think that's as good a time as any to take a break. We'll be right back in a moment with our number threes. All right, Sarah, you're up again. What is your number three film of the year?
It was a film that I was really anticipating because I'd read all the stories when I was a kid, at least two or three times. I did end up watching the film twice, second time with my dad as well. And he was a big fan of the books and he agreed with me that he thought it was an excellent film, and that was Tintin.
Tintin!
And I just thought it was... It really brought out the amazing characters that are... in the stories really, really well, and I can't wait for the next one. And I thought it just got too much bad press, actually, especially over here. There was one film critic that came out and said that she felt sick when she came out because it was so fast-paced. But that's how the stories are. I mean, they're only around, on average, around 63 pages long, and it's just, it was obviously just bit after bit after bit on each page. It does go very, very fast. That's the pace that he sets, and I thought it was excellent.
Very cool. Simon, you mentioned before that you really enjoyed it, of course.
So, yeah, so for me, yeah, no, I agree. Just like Sarah, I just thought it was incredible. I thought I loved it, and I just think any problems which people have with the film, generally, I think, are only really problems they'll have with Hergé, the creator of Tintin, because I think, you know, things like the dead eye thing, I think, is neither here nor there. I think you've got an issue with that. I don't understand, you know, do you not have a problem with The Lion King and... Beauty and the Beast. I mean, I just watched Tintin. It's an animated film. I don't watch it thinking it is real.
Right.
If anything, the artistry and the accuracy of it is incredible. And in fairness, some shots from certain Disney films, when you look at a beautiful landscape, often, you know, they're on look real. But you don't sit there and have a problem with the fact that they're not, or they're trying to be close to being accurate or one way or the other. So I think that's a really silly argument. But I think... issues in terms of, like Sarah said, the pace. Issue in terms of the characters like Haddock and the fact that there's no female characters in there except Bianca Castafiore at the end. You know what I mean? That's the books. That's what Hergé created. And I think it's the first film. They've got to start it off with a bang. They've managed to start it off with enough of a bang to make sure it keeps going. I think now it can only get better, I hope, in terms of how they add to the stories and add to the characters and build on it for the future. And I'm really looking forward to the next one, yeah.
You're never going to watch it again, are you?
No. I
oh, God.
It was not a bad movie. I'm not going to say that. I've never read the Tintin books. So I don't have an emotional connection to any of the characters. And I don't know if that's why I didn't like the characters. I had no issues with...
You like the dog.
Well, the dog was great. I will say, I would never say I didn't like the dog. Yeah. But I thought it was
Snowy.
To look
His
at.
Name
yeah.
is Snowy.
Yeah, she loved Snowy.
It was beautiful to look at. It was well animated. There was great action. It had all the elements, except I hated the character of Tintin. I thought he was a little pretentious shit. I was comparing it, it has no real comparison, to Goonies, just in the fact that they're going kind of on a treasure hunt. Where in Goonies, there were stakes. They needed to find this treasure because otherwise they were all going to lose their homes. And Tintin, I just found, he was just kind of there and he's like, we must find this. But for what? Even at least Indiana Jones thought things should be put in a museum. Tintin had no motivation other than just because he was there and it was there to be found. And because there was no purpose for it, I didn't find that he had enough fun with it to make it that he was just an adventurer. So I thought it needed to either be that he was just like a thrill seeker or he had a purpose, and I didn't think he had either. I fell asleep for a few
moments. I know.
My God!
I know! You know, this is what I'm dealing with here.
And
no heart! So amazing that Spielberg could do that to you.
I know.
Well done to him.
Well, I hope that I'll get Lindsay to watch it again at some point. I loved it. I really, really enjoyed it. I mentioned before how War Horse was Spielberg getting back to Color Purple and Empire of the Sun. For me, Tintin was him getting back to Raiders of the Lost Ark and Jurassic Park and those kind of films, and E.T. and those kind of films, where it was very much filled with wonder and adventure. And I've mentioned this before, between Tintin and Hugo, I really thought that it was a sign of what 3D can do when it's given to the right person. So I'm with you guys. I love Tintin a lot. Well, we will move on. Simon, your number three is going to come up later on, but briefly tell people what you liked about your next selection.
I've got Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's latest. I was looking forward to this for a long, long time. It was released in, I think, in America, like right at the start of the summer. And in the UK, it came in like October, late October. And the whole, and obviously it got, it opened the Cannes Film Festival in what, March or something. So, and it got great reviews then. So I was waiting for it desperately. And it was everything it lived up to being. And yeah, so I really loved it. So I'll come back to that when we come back to it later.
Yeah, I think I asked you about that about five times over the summer, like when we were doing the Film Locker. I think every third week I was like, hey, did you see Midnight in Paris yet? You kept telling me, shut up, it's not out here yet. We will come back to that one in a little bit. So that takes us back to Lindsay. And your number three, I know you've been waiting for this one for a year, so just get going.
Yes, well, after mentioning Lars von Trier, now we're back to the Lindsay that you know and love. Yeah. My number three is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Why?
I understand that it's Harry Potter and it's probably technically not considered one of the best films of the year. So this is just from my personal preference. It was the most satisfying film I saw this year, where the first time I saw it, I actually almost couldn't even take it in. I didn't even cry the first time I saw it because I was just so anxious to get it to the end.
I think you were watching it with your mouth open.
I was the whole time. And then I went back the next day, of course, naturally, and saw it again, and that time everything about it, it's just the characters we've been living with for, I think, 7 years. And it was just the closure that I needed, and it filled me with so much joy and heartache. And any movie that can cause me emotion like that is going to end up on my top 10.
I see. Guys, did you have any thoughts on the Harry Potter films? You're English.
Well, it's no Tintin.
Tintin.
No, I absolutely agree. I thought it was a really satisfying end, actually. And it was just nice to see them, not to reveal too much about the ending, but it was satisfying and it was nice to say goodbye to the characters in that way.
Yeah, part one, I wouldn't say I sided with you as much as you hated it, Ryan.
No, I didn't hate it. It's just incomplete.
But you were kind of anti it at the very least. You weren't on the kind of...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I kind of think... And it was a good payoff in comparison to that. I think what's really difficult is when you see... I mean, obviously, I watched all the films leading up to it, and when you see them kind of all in their little installments... And they all have their kind of peak points at the end. But when you get to the final one and they're trying to kind of go crazy and Hogwarts is, you know, falling to pieces and they're fighting in the rubble and you're a bit like, oh my God, I'm tired. Oh. It's just blowing the doors off. I liked it. I think I just didn't put it in my top five, I think, because I think I'm just not as invested in the franchise. I like them, I enjoy them. And in fairness, in the same way things like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, I think I always get a bit put off by the whole cult following of things. When the followings are like cult and a bit crazy and people dress up and go to clubs, I think it kind of makes me go, yeah, no, I like it.
I am just one of those people.
I know, yeah.
I am one of those nerds. I have thrown, in my adult life, I have thrown maybe 5 Harry Potter themed parties and none of them involve children.
I think the bottom line is they just adapted it so well. I mean, I think, you know, you just think it's just so sad that you have films like Golden Compass or Twilight. Percy Jackson. Twilight. I don't know about Twilight. I haven't seen any of them. But I kind of think, like, with the films which just don't get those good adaptations and fall at the first hurdle, you just think, oh, what a shame. Because you just think, like, how Harry Potter, that last one, like I was saying, it's just everything. And they can do that where they kind of reflect on the previous films and they can have characters coming back and forth and all that type of thing. And that's so satisfying. I think you're quite lucky if you loved Harry Potter and then those films came out, because they were so faithful and so careful with what they were doing there.
Yeah. Now, to be clear, I did enjoy the living heck out of this one. It wasn't on my list, but I did love it. It is a very satisfying conclusion. Well, my number three is next, and my number three I'm just going to talk about briefly because it is actually the film that's going to come up the most in this episode. My number three is The Skin I Live In, the new film by Pedro Almodovar. Simon, when we talked about him on the Film Walker, I mentioned how much I was looking forward to this film, and I think at the time we thought it was supposed to be a straight-up horror film, which, of course, it's not, and I think what the film actually is really, really fantastic, and I was really, really impressed to see that kind of story come out of Almodovar. But we'll get back to that in a little bit, and we'll come back right after this with our number twos.
It's been a long time
Well, speaking of Almodovar, Sarah, what's your number two?
Well, surprise, surprise. Yep, Skin I Live In. I know. We'll discuss it in a bit more detail, but it was a very clever film, and Antonio Banderas was amazing. I thought he was just got that balance between being a really nice character in it, but also this really evil kind of sinister side to him as well. I thought he really lifted the film, and I just loved the imagery in the film as well. I just thought it was very thought-provoking.
Did you watch any of the other Almodovar stuff with Simon?
You watch a few of them.
I've seen a couple of them.
Sometimes she'd walk in halfway through one and she'd be...
That's the worst.
And she'd be like, what on earth are you watching? I mean, Bad Education was one of them, where you got two guys making out on screen and I'm just like, hello! Yep, just watching some Almodovar.
It's just better cinema, honey. Really, it's okay.
I swear.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about it a little bit more in a minute. But, Simon, your number two is a really somewhat underrated film that came out quite some time ago here but kind of flew under the radar. So what's your number two film of the year?
Again, this is one which I think was released last year for a lot of people, and we didn't get it until very early this year. But it's Animal Kingdom. I mean, I absolutely love this film. I thought, I had that, I'm all out of love, I'm so left without you. I had it in my on my iPlayer for a long time, on my iPod. I just really love the kind of sinister edge to it. It had this certain realism to it, but it was like the fact that you had this family who were just... There was a balance between they didn't really realise how horrible they were at the same time, and yet at the same, you know, you had this boy who was kind of like just working it all out, and I loved it. I mean, I've got to watch it again, but I absolutely loved it. I came out, I absolutely adored it.
Very cool. Sarah, did you see that one as well?
Yes, I did. I thought it was really good. I thought there was a lot of shocking moments in it, and it became unpredictable at points as well, and lots of little surprises which kept you on your feet. And I just thought, I can't remember his name, the guy who played the main character. I just thought he had this, some of his facial expressions, he was just so much tension in his face, and he was having to hold so many emotions, and you just thought any moment he's going to explode, he can't possibly cope with everything that's happening to him, and he just had that intensity, that presence when you're watching the film, and it really rested on him heavily, and I just thought he was a really good actor, perfect for the role, but also just physically, he looked sort of not sort of your typical lead actor either, because he was quite plain sort of looking, and he looked, no offence, but kind of non-descriptive in a way. But that's exactly what it needed, because he was just able to bring so much emotion to the role.
A lot of the adverts as well for it kind of sold the film as this kind of like there's a threat from within, and that this, you know, it kind of starts off. But I think that whole idea of that guy turning on his family effectively, though it sold and it was advertised like that, but it's only in the last act really does that happen. And so the whole first two acts, you're kind of seeing just him involved and witnessing what's going on, and kind of you personally, I feel like you're getting involved seeing what's happening. So, I don't know, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
You didn't see that one, did you?
No.
I did see it, and for me, the movie was very, very, very much about Jackie Weaver, who plays the kind of matriarch of the family named Smurf. And just watching this character who you think has nothing to do with nothing for the longest time and seems to be completely above the fray and have no idea what's going on, seeing her true colors come out when they do is just absolutely jaw-dropping, the amount of involvement that she actually has in this crime family. So I'm with you. I really, really dug it. It was one that I was kind of grumpy that I didn't catch up with in theaters, but I did see it on DVD later. Great choice. As I say, it is a hold for all of us. It's a holdover from 2010, but one that I still think more people should see. It's a really, really great crime story. That takes us to Lindsay, whose number two has already been mentioned. So what was your number two about for the year?
My number two is Midnight in Paris.
Very nice. And do tell people about your spotted history with Woody Allen.
I don't like Woody Allen. I think he's self-indulgent, and I just do not enjoy his films at all. And I don't even know what made me see this film. I didn't know what it was about.
Peer pressure.
No, it was actually convenience. I finished work early, and I had a half day at work, and I was on my way home, and I thought I'll just pop in and see a movie. And that one, it was like 1:30 in the afternoon. That one was starting in 5 minutes. It was literally just convenient, so I went and I thought, well, it's short, I'll go in. And I saw it the next night with some girlfriends. I was blown away by it. I didn't know what it was going to be about. I think it helps that Woody Allen is now too old to cast himself in the romantic leads.
I think that's going to stop him.
I think if he made this movie even 15 years ago, he would have played the Owen Wilson character.
Probably.
And that would have been a different film. And it wouldn't. But I don't want to give anything about this movie away, because I went into it not knowing at all what the plot was about. And I was just so surprised. It didn't feel like a regular Woody Allen movie. It was whimsical. And I don't even know how to describe it without giving anything away.
I see.
My only flaw is that some of the characters were a little one-note. Like, they made Rachel McAdams a little too horrible of a person.
But that was cool, because when you see Rachel Adams, you don't think...
Like, who doesn't like Rachel
Adams? I was going to say, you don't see her to be the raving bitch that they turn her into in this movie, so...
And Michael Sheen is always perfect. I just loved everybody.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Owen Wilson was just so charming and lovable, and yeah, I don't even know how to... I'm not being very eloquent, but I don't know how to describe how much I loved this movie.
No, you're getting across your love for this movie quite well. Sarah, did you catch up with this one?
Yeah, I did. I agree. I don't actually like his films either. I've seen bits of them. Simon's made me watch some of his films. I find him ridiculous. It makes no sense at all that he gets all these females in the lead parts who have to fall in love with him. I just feel sorry for those actresses. I don't like his films at all. And I went to go and watch this one. Again, I knew nothing about it, but I absolutely loved it. I just thought imaginative. And Owen Wilson was surprising. I didn't think there was that side to him, actually. I'd only seen him in films like, is it Wedding Crashers? Is in that one?
Yeah.
Films like that, it's just, but with this one, I just a sensitive side to him.
I think it's got a great love of art and a great love of literature. And I think that's something which, I mean, I'm not so much a literature person. So I didn't get much of the literature kind of references which he makes, because there's a whole balance as well, I think, between what appreciation is and about, you have this kind of pseudo intellectual who's almost showing off his intellect, and he's almost going on about how this and this and this, but it's like it seems so false. Whereas Owen Wilson's character, he's very much more in tune with it because he's so honest about it. And I think that's something really great as well. I know when I saw the trailer for it, even at that point, I was thinking this is going to be brilliant, because I thought Owen Wilson's delivery of Woody Allen's script was just perfect. I mean, it was. I do feel like Owen Wilson is like he'd be a great kind of person to take over Woody Allen's, like, you know, vernacular, as it were, when he does that role, because he can do that kind of cynicism and that kind of when kind of insulting himself. Yeah, he cannot self-deprecating. Perfect. He self-depreciates himself all the time, and that again, it's so perfectly cast. And I think that's what the best thing about the film. On the one side, like I said, you have all that literature and art references, which are really great for anybody who likes art or literature. And at the same time, Owen Wilson's delivery, his performance, is just so likable and so accessible. Which is why Woody Allen films, I like all of Woody Allen's films, but I think that's why they are so good, because his character is quite accessible. Obviously, if you don't like him, then you never will access his type of thing. But the point is that generally, I think that's what's so good, and I think Owen Wilson delivers it perfectly.
I'm with you guys. I really, really love this movie. Like Hugo, it just missed my list. I saw it knowing nothing at all, except for the fact that it was a new Woody Allen movie. And I think we've kind of danced around the surprise of the film. It's not a twist. It's not like it's a great twist ending. But it's a surprise that the movie deliberately did not put out there when it was marketing itself. And I think that decision to keep the surprise of the film, to keep that quiet until people got in there and see it, it's the kind of thing that you don't see anymore in movie marketing. And I think for us, it worked really, really well, that it had this unexpected joy to it. I also, quite now, am reveling in the fact that between Lindsay and I, one of us had Woody Allen and Lars von Trier in our top five, and it was not me. But my number two, which I'm going to talk about very briefly, is The Artist. Has that come out over there yet, guys?
No.
It's another one of these films. It's kind of becoming a theme for my list. It was just unexpected. It's a movie that is very, very much a callback to a forgotten time, and for it to play in a modern audience as well as it does, with as much joy and as much heart, is amazing. I didn't know what I was going to be getting into going in. I know a little bit about silent cinema, but I wouldn't exactly call myself an expert. And it's just so very well executed, but I think, again, we're going to talk about it in another minute. So, that is our number twos, and we'll be right back with our number ones after this. But before we do, here are some other people who you have heard on the Matinee Cast in 2011 talking about their choices for number one.
Hey, Matinee Cast listeners, this is Andrew James from the Cinecast over at row3.com. My favorite movie of the year is Pedro Almodovar's The Skin I Live In. Everybody have a fabulous new year, and we'll see you in 2012.
Hey, this is Jandy from Row 3 in Los Angeles, California, and the best film I saw this year was The Tree of Life.
Hi, it's Bob Trimble from the blog Eternal Sunshine of the Logical Mind, as well as Row3.com and the J Film Powwow, where I'm a contributing writer. My number one film of the year is, without a doubt, an easy pick this year, is Jean-Marc Vallée's Café de Flore.
Hi, this is Anna from Splitbrew, Finland. The best film I saw this year was Drive.
Hi everybody, this is Kai coming to you from California. I am the co-founder of the world-famous MetaLoveFilms.com and host of the MILFcast. And while it's a little bit early for me to be picking what I think is the best film of the year, I can honestly say that, surprisingly, the best time I had in theaters all year was seeing the film Real Steel with my kids. They say it's like Rocky with robots, but that's okay, because I actually love Rocky, and I love robots.
This is Sam Fragoso from Duke in the Movies, and my favorite film from 2011 is Mike Mills' beautiful, touching, and ultimately life-affirming picture, Beginners.
This is the Danger Girl from Danger Girl Photography, and I'm going to say my favorite movie this year was actually In Time.
Hi, this is Corey Atad from justatad.wordpress.com in Toronto, Ontario, and the best film I saw this year was War Horse.
This is Greg Ashman from Critical Mass Cast. My number one film for 2001 is Lars von Trier's Melancholia.
This is Lesia from Eternity of Dream, and the best film that I have seen this year was Midnight in Paris.
Hi, this is Steve Johnston from the Film Cynics in Toronto, Ontario, and the best film I saw in 2011 was Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive, starring Ryan Gosling. Fantastic.
This is James McNally from Toronto Screenshots in Toronto, Canada, and the best film that I saw this year was The Tree of Life.
This is Rachel of Rachel's Real Reviews and the Real Insight podcast in the USA, and my favorite 2011 film was Melancholia.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, film fans. This is Mark Chaffardini from GoSeeTalk.com in Dallas, Texas. And the best movie I saw this year was 13 Assassins.
Hey Ryan, Kurt here. Just looking to chime in with my favorite film of 2011, and that would be Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. One of the best looking films of the year. There's nothing that looks like it. Incredibly ambitious and incredibly awe-inspiring to look at. Nothing even comes close in 2011. Cheers, buddy.
That's a lot of people who you heard on the show this year talking about their number ones. Some real variety there, but it's time for us to get on with it and get to our top choices. Sarah, I dare say that your number one was actually a bit of a surprise when Lindsay and I read it. So why don't you get us started? What is your top film of the year?
It is Trishna, directed by Michael Winterbottom, and it was a surprising film for me to the London Film Festival, and Simon always books the tickets up for that, and I knew nothing about the film when I went in, and I came out just shocked and just lots of thoughts about what had happened to the main character of Trishna and her relationship with Jay. I just thought it was beautiful in terms of how it had been shot. It really captured aspects of India and the poverty that she was living in with her family. It just was very realistic. It just showed day-to-day normal jobs that they would be doing, how she had to look after the children, And then that was juxtaposed with Jay's background. It was obviously based on the Test of the D'Urberville by Tom Hardy, and I just found it really disturbing what happened to her and also him. And there was no right or wrong in terms of the reasons why they did what they did. I mean, you can understand both sides of the story, but it was truly horrific by the end. It was for days and days and days that I was thinking about the two characters, and it was quite a big emotional reaction to it. And I really want to watch it again, actually, just to kind of reflect a bit more about the two characters. But I was truly shocked by it, and it had the most emotional impact for me of all the films that I watched this year.
Interesting. Simon?
Yeah, I mean, I really liked it. I think, I mean, a lot of the things which Sarah liked, I completely appreciated. It did look, it looked stunning. And again, Frida Pinto holds her own as well. I mean, she's brilliant in the lead role. I don't know how much, I wouldn't put it, maybe I didn't put it in my top five, obviously. But I do kind of still stand by the fact that I think it is a stunning film. I mean, it hasn't got its nationwide release in the UK yet. We just saw it in the film festival.
Yeah.
I doubt it released in the UK, in the US or Canada yet, has it?
No.
No, we saw it at the film festival as well.
Yeah, we saw it at the Toronto International Film Festival around the same time as you guys.
So I question when it gets its release, what the reaction will be then. Because it's got some interest. I'd be very surprised. I mean, it seemed like such a strong film. I'd be very surprised Radar, because I thought it was brilliant.
Go ahead.
All right. When I was ranking my films, I made a list of all the films, first run films that I saw this year, and there were 73 that I saw in a theater. Out of the 73, Trishna is ranked at 72.
Ooh! How?
That's like how? When I saw it on your list, I was like, what? I don't know if we saw the same
film. How?
Yeah, it's the only thing. It's behind Green Lantern and ahead of Mr. Tree.
Jeez.
In terms of films that I
saw. Did you see Cars 2?
I did. That's like number in the 60s somewhere.
Oh my God.
I really didn't like Trishna. Well, I was actually quite angered by it because it was, Ryan and I have a tradition when we go to the film festival that we always see, because we tend to not have the same taste in films, so we see films quite separately and we're not together a lot during the festival. But the last film of every festival, we make sure we see together, so we kind of close out the festival. And he picked that one, and it was just, it was endless. It just went on and on and on. And by the time it ended, we were so angry that we'd ended the festival on that one, because if we'd seen like one less movie that day, we would have had a good closing festival. And we went over Indian food beforehand to kind of get us in the mood. I love Indian cinema. I thought it was beautiful looking, but it just felt like he thought he saw Frida Pinto in Slumdog Millionaire and went, she's pretty, let's put her in a movie, and then didn't really have anywhere to go with it.
For me, I'm more on Lindsay's side as well here. I like Michael Winterbottom a lot.
So do I. Yes.
I find his films very interesting, but I find that every once in a while, usually like every third or fourth movie, he makes something that I just can't get behind. And the underlying story of Trishna is like you say, it's really, really interesting story. It's really dark, and it's very, very heavy. It was kind of odd though, because there's a lot of moments where he almost seems a little too in love with India, and he goes on these long montages. To get from A to B within the scene.
And I found Frida Pinto blank. I didn't care about her character one way or another. I didn't like her, I didn't dislike her. Like, you like her for the first while and you kind of feel for her, but by the end she doesn't portray any kind of emotion, and not the kind of way that, you know, sometimes you feel like, oh, they have the emotion but they're suppressing it. But I don't know that she pulled that off, because her character was empty, and by the end I didn't care honestly what happened to her one way or another. I thought she wasn't a strong female character.
But she was so conflicted. I mean, that's the thing, is that she was this... I mean, it wasn't a case of... I mean, it's a case of just guy falls in love with girl falls in love with guy, and that's it. I mean, I think the problem is you had this really balance between what she believed, because this is the thing, this is what's so fascinating about it, is that she believed her role in her family was one thing, her role as a wife to this man and her role as an employee in this hotel. She defined herself in these different facets, and I just kind of think, actually, she was conflicted, because it's so archaic, it's dated, the attitudes are so old, and obviously the Riz Ahmed, he abuses those positions, he's not a part of that culture, he doesn't necessarily see it in the same light, and there was a complete conflict there in terms of who who they are and their identity. And again, that's what we were saying, that's what Sarah was saying, and about class and their social status, about these people from these completely opposing sides, and how it's so destructive because of the society expectations of what they should or shouldn't be in society. And I found that absolutely fascinating. That was the most interesting part.
I agree, because she has a role at home, and then when she's finally with him, she goes from one extreme to another. Of now she can be a kept woman who's not expected to do anything else, and she doesn't know how to deal with the two worlds that she finds herself in. She's never allowed to find herself apart from the time that she does the dance classes. That's the time that you think actually you could see her character coming through, and it's so brief, and you're thinking that's her outlet, that's where you're going to see who this Trishna really is and what she's capable of, and then it's taken from her as quick as anything. She doesn't have the opportunity as a character to be herself. She is there for other people.
Sarah, I always say that when it comes time to pick like your favorite films or your favorite films of the year, that kind of thing, if you can pick something divisive, something that that some people love and some people hate, that you've probably picked very, very well. So even though I can't still get behind Trishna, and I do see very well what you're saying of the story, I must applaud your gumption in picking something that's not exactly what you'd call universally acclaimed. So very, very well done. And now the rest of us are all going to pick very, very standard answers.
My voice is gone again.
Simon, you're up next. We've mentioned your number one a few times, but let's get into it. What was your top film of 2011?
The Skin I Live In, Pedro Almodovar's latest film. I thought it was incredible. And I think what was great about it, we saw it with a couple of friends ourselves when we watched it. And when we came out, we went to the pub and we discussed the film. And I think when you first come out of it, you're just kind of like, oh, that was a great yarn, you know, as they say, and it was just a good story. But the more you talk about it, the more you realize that it's got so many levels, so many ideas about, again, identity, sexuality, you know, sexism, and attitudes to, you know, towards femininity, masculinity, what defines a man, what defines a woman. All these types of things are rooted in this film and littered throughout. I mean, every character has these kind of almost dual roles. And there's certain, like, which are almost contradictory in terms of, like, the one male character who, you know, when he tries to sleep with Antonio Banderas' daughter. He's like a character, and when he does that, you kind of think, because he didn't really do anything wrong there, really. I mean, he tried to kind of, he was a bit more pressured her a little bit too much, perhaps, but he didn't rape her, he didn't abuse her, he was just a bit too forward. So then you're kind of thinking, so what does that mean, and whatnot? So I think there's really fascinating ideas about masculine roles, feminine roles, sexuality, all those type of things. And I think the more you talk about it, the more you think about it afterwards, the better. And crucially, don't read anything about it before you watch it. Just watch it.
No kidding. Sarah, you talked about it a little bit before, but any more thoughts on The Skin I Live In?
Yeah, I mean, I said about Antonio Banderas before. I just thought he really lifted the film. And I just thought there wasn't a minute wasted in that film at all. It was continuously moving the story forward. There was lots of little surprises. And wouldn't you realise the...
surprises?
Once you... realised certain things about certain characters, it just became even more shocking, and it's enjoyable sometimes when you do watch things that are very uncomfortable. How do you react to that when you're in the cinema and you kind of want to talk about it straight away because you can't believe what you're watching? And I thought that was a really strong reaction to have, actually. And like Simon said, we had lots of debates, lots of discussions about it, and I can't wait to watch it again.
Is this killing you that we're being very elusive about something and you're kind of curious as to what's going on?
No, I don't... Who's in this one? Why haven't I seen it?
Antonio Banderas is in it. It's the new Almodovar film.
Why haven't I seen it?
I don't know, actually.
The girl!
This was a hard-to-get ticket at TIFF.
Yes, it was a very hard-to-get ticket.
And did you see it? You saw it at TIFF, though.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, then that's why I haven't seen it.
Okay.
This was not an accessible ticket.
Okay, well, we will catch up with it soon, because you do need to see it. I will say this. The one thing I forgot to mention earlier is that when I did see it at TIFF, it was my first screening of the day. It was a 9 a.m. show on the last day, so I was exhausted when I saw this movie the first time, so much so that I actually kind of nodded off for about 5 minutes, and when I woke up I was like, wait a second, what's going on? I'm like, you're waking up and you're wondering if you're still asleep because what you're seeing just seems so surreal and just very, very odd. But yeah, it's really, really rare these days where you can see something genuinely surprising and shocking in a movie. And when I caught up with this one, I have seen it again. I've seen it full out. And also watching it play full out, knowing everything, it's a really, really wonderful experience. So, you know, as wonderful as a film like this can be, I think there's a reason why it's the one that's on our lists the most. Lindsay, you're up. What was your top film of the year, which sadly Simon and Sarah have not yet seen?
My top film is The Artist.
And why?
Why not? I know we've had many conversations about this film with some friends who feel otherwise, but I think it was the most innovative film of the year. And I know it's weird to say innovative because it's a black and white silent film that has a nod to early cinema, but nobody's made a film like this in a really long time. It's very similar in story to Singing in the Rain. So, I mean, the story is nothing new, but, I mean, by the end of this film, my heart is filled with such joy, and I am so excited along with the characters. And there's little moments in this film, even though it's a silent film, like John Goodman's in this, and every time he's on screen, it's funny. Even though you can't hear what he's saying, you kind of know what's happening. He's hilarious. James Cromwell has a very tiny role, and in maybe the 5 minutes of screen time he has in this, he's probably the most lovable character in any film this year, without saying anything. It's just such a beautiful film. But the fact that I remember the characters' names. I don't remember the characters' names from any other film this year if the character wasn't Hugo or Tintin, if their names weren't in the title. But I know Pepe Miller and, like, George Valentin were the main characters in this silent film where no one ever speaks their name. I just felt such love for this basic, simple story. And it's kind of a love story, and I just...
Yeah. And there's a very charming dog.
And there's a dog that's better than the dog in Tintin, actually.
Whoa!
No, you have to see this film because this dog, it's probably the most charming animal character in a very long time. I actually can't think of another dog that's been more charming.
From Frasier or something?
No, the dog in this story has quite a significant role, I would say.
Yeah.
He's like the sidekick character.
Basically, yes.
And he's so charming and sweet and adorable. And again, in a silent film, this dog has so much character. Maybe because nobody speaks, that having the dog also not speak, he's like an equal character, I find, to everybody else.
Yeah. Guys, I know that you haven't seen it yet because it hasn't played over there, but do you have any thoughts of going into it? Anything you've heard? Any questions? Anything like that?
I definitely want to see it. I'm really, really keen to watch it. I think it's a bit... When at the London Film Festival, there was an opportunity for me to go and see it, but the ticket was just a bit too expensive, and so I decided not to. But now I kind of look back and I kind of think, I should have done it.
I think the film's real achievement is how it plays to a modern audience. You know, we're in a society where we want bigger and better, and we've become a little bit more attention deprived. And it has such charm, and it keeps the story so, you know, very, very pointed, but very, very simple. And I really can't wait for you guys to catch up with it, because I do think that it is one of the very, very best films of the year. And
what's the lead actor? Jean Dujardin? Is that his
name? Jean Dujardin.
He's, I think, brilliant in this film. And he's my new crush.
Is he?
Yes, he is my new crush.
he's very Clooney-esque. He's very Clark Gable. He's very, you know, he's got a little bit of Errol Flynn all kind of rolled into one. So yeah, guys, I do hope that you get to check it out. There's a weird little look back to silent cinema happening right now between this film and Hugo, and I kind of wonder about that with, you know, everything that we talked about in Midnight in Paris about nostalgia.
A lot of the films were very nostalgic this year.
Yeah, you kind of got to worry about that if we're looking backwards more than we're looking forward. Sarah, any thoughts on The Artist before we move on?
I think I'd be interested. I mean, I know we've had a brief discussion about the 3D at the minute and about all the advances visually in film. I think it's nice that a director's been daring and gone back to a different way of using visuals in films to tell a story, going back to basics. So hopefully, it should be, from all the press it's been getting, it will be successful, because I think that's a brave decision to make.
Well, it's my turn for the number one, and this will probably surprise very few people. It might surprise a few people, I don't know.
But I can't think of what it is.
Then you're not thinking hard enough. My number one is Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life.
Ooh, boo. No, I shouldn't say that. I haven't seen it. I'm just saying that sounds just as pretentious as it should be for your
of
number
course.
One.
Now, I can't recall. Simon and Sarah, have you guys seen it?
I tried to hunt it down a while back, but it was just a bit too much out of the price bracket for me, I'm afraid. So I had to wait.
So my number one film, I'm the only one who's seen it. I've got to talk about this by myself. Okay.
How you like it.
Yeah, thank you. Basically, the reason why I put it at my number one is that it did something that I have very, very rarely seen. It's film-going poetry is what it is. It's not really, really interested in being a story. The story you can sum up in about three sentences. It's a 1960s family growing up in Texas. That's the story. And it's, you know, one of the sons looks back on it in his adult life. But the way that it plays with images, the way it plays with sound, the way it just asks more questions than it provides answers, it was not something that you see on a big screen with a big budget with big stars behind it anymore. So, while, yeah, it is a pretentious film, and yes, it is not exactly something I'd call accessible, it's also something that will challenge you as a viewer, and it's something that does some very, very different things. And I can't remember the last time I saw a film and ended up having my brain wander and asking all of these philosophical questions in a movie theater. It's just so beautiful and so elegant that I couldn't get it out of my head. I saw it once in theaters, and I've watched it again on Blu-ray, and it's just really, really fantastic. Again, I realize that you guys haven't seen it, but did you have any thoughts on it at all?
I remember it came out on my birthday, and Sarah said, you know, we were going to go and see it, and I just remember thinking, I wasn't in the mood. And I think that's the problem with a film like that, is that you kind of feel like you have to kind of build yourself up to it. And I feel like I'm closer now, but even now I kind of feel like I don't even know enough about Terrence Malick to really watch it either. I mean, as I understand, I think you even said this on your podcast a short while ago, that he's a director, which it's good to start from Badlands and work your way through his canon, working your way up.
Yes.
Something like Tree of Life. And so, you know, in that regard, that's something which I'd like to try and do. And unfortunately, I've only watched Badlands so far. I've got The Thin Red Line, but I haven't watched any of the others. So, you know what I mean? I don't want to kind of ruin the experience for myself. But at the same time, the ideas and the thoughts and, like you said, all those philosophical stuff, I really do want to get to grips with. I know it came up a lot in the Sight and Sound critics poll. A lot of people said it was their best film of the year. I don't know. I really don't know what to make of it. I mean, I will watch it. It's just a matter of time, I think.
Could be, Sarah. Any thoughts on it at all?
I'm the same. I wanted to watch it. I've heard it was going to be a difficult film, and I was shocked by Simon's reaction, because I don't normally get that when we go to watch a film, and he was really unsure about going to watch it. So yeah, I'll be interested to see it. And there's some surprising actors who are in the film as well, so I'll be interested to see what they've done within it, and I'm sure I'll watch it very soon.
Definitely. Do you have any preconceptions that you want
to... Well, to be honest, I really haven't seen Terrence Malick films.
Okay, so we might go on a little...
I'm trying to open my mind. This past year, I've gone to the theater to see some movies that I would normally not have seen.
Yeah.
Especially...
heavier, philosophical...
Like, I went back and saw Lawrence of Arabia in 70mm.
And how'd that work out for you?
Worst experience of my life.
Yeah.
But, no, I shouldn't say that. But I will give this a shot. It's just because I've heard all the stories about how kind of... Everyone keeps talking about how great and boring this movie is. Everyone's saying it's great and it's boring at the same time. So for me to get motivated to sit and watch it is...
Okay.
Is difficult.
Well, we'll see.
I know you've been pushing it.
We'll
You're see. Like a like pusher.
I'm trying to be passive aggressive about it, and you know, just gently suggest. I'm like, hey, we've got Tree of Life. It's on the shelf there. You know, we can watch it anytime you want.
Ryan, what about the rewatchability of it? Do you think you're going to watch it again?
Yes.
Multiple times?
Absolutely. It's
the kind of film that you watch it multiple times.
Yeah, dude, I fall asleep watching Schindler's List. Okay, it's beautiful. It's the kind of film that I could put on just to have something to look at while I'm doing other things. Yeah, it does have an unexpected rewatchability. It's, as I say, it's a film that I know a lot of people have a lot of problems with, but I just... the common thread to my choices, right from the Muppets to the artist, was the feeling I got in the cinema, and I definitely cannot discount the feeling I got watching Tree of Life, so that's why it's my number one. That is all for this very epic matinee cast. Come on back for episode 50 on January 16th. I don't actually know which title we'll be talking about, but we'll figure it out between now and then. Simon's writing can be found at Screen Insight, which is screeninsight.blogspot.com.
Yeah.
Good. It can also be found occasionally at flickeringmyth.com and at manilovefilms.com. Do you have anything coming up on any one of those in the new year?
I think I'm going to be writing, as you know, I'm sure, I've done all those posts on the Rocky films and on Star Wars, and I'm going to be doing a few on the Alien films coming up, preceding Prometheus, so that should be quite fun.
Very cool.
The Rocky films, we should point out, are on my side of the shelf, not yours.
That's one little beacon in the shelf of doom. And where can people find you on Twitter, buddy?
Just at Screen Insight.
We should also mention that we are in the planning stages of Series 2 of the Film Locker, so you should see that sometime before the summer.
I think a lot of people had a bit of trouble getting that Roman Polanski episode. I think it's easier to get now.
Oh, well, that's good. I hope people listen to it, because I actually had a lot of fun recording that one.
Yeah.
Sarah, are you on Twitter at all?
No, I'm not.
So if people want to find you, they just got to find you.
Well, I'm not normally allowed to have a voice very much, so it's only for today.
Well, you know, if you want to contribute, I'm always looking for writers.
Oh, thank you.
Sweetheart, where can people find you on Twitter if they want to?
At Lindsay Ragone.
There we go.
LandsayRagone.
My site is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes at thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry and the iTunes Music Store, and they all give you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on our top fives and on 2012 films that you're looking forward to can be sent to ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I am matinee_ca, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee, and drop me a line, I'll get back to you. Any last thoughts, people? Don't all talk at once.
All right, well, it's been a good year for film. Really diverse films have come out this year, and I haven't known a year for film like this for quite some time, so it's been really good.
Very good. And Sarah, if I may say, it was nice getting to speak with you for more than, you know, two syllables at a time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it as well. I'm enjoying having a voice.
Simon, we've got to have her on the show sometime.
No.
Well, for Simon and Lindsay, I'm Ryan McNeil. All the very best for 2012. Happy New Year, and we'll see you at the matinee. Just have to keep a dialogue. Teach your buddies on the call.